Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're back with Reality Check Radio, Greenwashed with Don and Jaspreet. And our guest today is someone who you will all know, but I'm going to build into him, into his background. And he was born in the North Kaipara Harbour at, I think it's Matakohe, farms there, attended the schools there, went to Auckland Grammar School in 1961, has an animal science degree from the University of Adelaide. Before entering politics, he went and lectured at Massey University. He was a television quiz master for children's quiz shows like It's Academic, and was also marketing manager at the New Zealand Dairy Board. And so who am I speaking of? Well, I'm speaking of Sir Lockwood Smith. He was also an MP for Kaipara and then Rodney from 1984 till 2008. And since, actually 2013, sorry, when he was a List MP in the end. And then he went to be New Zealand's High Commissioner in the UK. So I'm talking of Sir Lockwood Smith. It's our great pleasure to have him on our show because he has a lot of experience and we would love to have some of that on our show. So welcome, Sir Lockwood. And what has been, you know, if you asked, what is your legacy? What do you think it would have been? Because I think it's massive, by the way. And aside, I missed one component. You were Speaker of the House of Parliament for some time as well. And I watched you consummately directing the traffic in Parliament. And I think that's a big task. So anyway, what would you think your legacy has been if you look back over your sort of 50-odd years in sort of public life?
Goodness, that's a bit of a challenging question to put to a
straight
politician. Don, I don't know whether I'd claim any great legacy. There have been areas where I'd like to think I've made some contribution as Minister of Education, for example, the industry training organisations, their whole ITO system for industry training was basically my idea. I put it in place and it still stands there today, even though I was minister way back in the early 90s, that whole structure of industry training where industry gets far more input is still there. As Minister of Tourism, I actually brought in the 100% Pure campaign in the late 90s, and that's still there and winning sort of global awards 20-odd years later. But more recently, I suppose as Minister for International Trade, you know, I broke the logjam that enabled China to enter the World Trade Organization. I was the first minister to sign them up to the World Trade Organization. And of course, China rates that as one of their four firsts with New Zealand. And I still think it was the right thing to do. You know, I know, China's posed some challenging issues for global trade, but so do other countries. I mean, the United States at the moment is causing huge difficulties for the World Trade Organization, for example. And so, you know, in every area, be it education, in agriculture, I initiated the whole reform of the dairy, of the New Zealand Dairy Board that led to the formation of Fonterra, because at the time I was hoping we'd actually be able to negotiate a free trade agreement with the United States. And I knew we'd never get that while we had the Dairy Board in place. Having worked for the New Zealand Dairy Board, I was very familiar with it. So in all those areas, I hope, you know, I was able to contribute something. But more recently, perhaps, after my time, I wasn't just High Commissioner to the United Kingdom. I was also Ambassador to Ireland and High Commissioner to both Ghana and Nigeria. But following my time in the United Kingdom, I spent a lot of time there discussing agriculture policy and trade policy and sharing with British people New Zealand's experience from the mid-80s of liberating markets, of getting rid of barriers to trade. Often used to talk about the massive productivity improvement in our sheep industry when the subsidies that amounted in the mid-90s or early 1980s up to 70% of the value of our production, when those subsidies were wiped in 1985, you know, the massive productivity improvement from 1990 to today, staggering, 170% thereabouts improvement in productivity. If the rest of the New Zealand economy had done anything like that, New Zealand would be such a wealthy place. And likewise, in Britain, people were so nervous of removing barriers to trade. They'd say, oh, if we allow competition from overseas markets, that inevitably it'll lead to a race to the bottom. That's the, I used to hear that, especially from Labour politicians in the UK. And what I was able to share with them was, look at New Zealand's wine industry. Once protected by a 40% tariff in the mid-1980s, 40% tariff on imported wines. In 1985, that was wiped. In 1985, New Zealand had a wine lake. You couldn't export New Zealand wine. You couldn't sell it overseas. It was so bad. It was battery acid. Yet today, New Zealand commands the highest average price of any country in the world on the UK market by quite a margin now, higher than France, higher than Australia, higher than the United States. New Zealand wines command the highest average price despite not having the hugely expensive wines that some French wines are. And of course, what I was able to point out to them is when you remove barriers to trade in a developed economy like New Zealand's or the United Kingdom, you don't get a race to the bottom because there's no point in us trying to compete down there. You, in fact, get a race to the top. And that's what happened with New Zealand's wine industry. New Zealand led the world in stainless steel fermentation, in management of grape canopies, in the development of screw caps on bottles. New Zealand led the world in all those technologies. And that's what happens when you remove barriers to trade. Competition can deliver so much productivity improvement, so much innovation. And New Zealand really is a world-class story on what can be achieved through liberalizing markets. And sadly, too few New Zealanders actually know the value of their own story.
And that was my next question. So, Lockwood, it was New Zealanders don't know this. I mean, I've lived this sort of story from the productivity gains in the sheep industry, especially, and then the venison industry, and effectively even into forestry. But it's not well known, and we constantly get harangued and harassed about our perhaps footprint on the planet being deleterious to too many people, and we should back off. But in effect, the use of the environment is what we do. We do it in an improved way each year, I would hope. But there's too many people that appear to still want to challenge our use of the environment as if they don't feel any benefit from it. And of course, I read a post this morning saying farmers, those nasty farmers, they're all dirty. They don't pay for their externalities. They expect the consumers to pay for it. Well, that's the problem. We don't perhaps tell our story well enough about who actually benefits from the use of the environment and the science around people that actually are first stage harvesters of that. So how would you see it? I mean, you talked about brand, the pure brand in the late 90s. I've got a view, and I want to you to expand on it if you can, that it's on one hand a really good thing to have a country sort of state saying it's clean and green and 100% pure, but it sort of appears to have been used as a straitjacket as well by the NGOs to challenge our very being, and it seems counterproductive. Or am I just making a mountain out of a molehill here?
Well, no, I don't think you are, Don. I think the 100% pure campaign was never intended to mean 100% pure environmentally. What it was intended to do, what I dreamed it would achieve, was 100% the best. 100% pure to me means the best. And in many areas, New Zealand is the best in the world. And it doesn't mean that we're perfect. I think in all environmental considerations, we've always got to be aiming to do better. I mean, I've been farming all my parliamentary life. I ran the farm. I ran it from London. I ran the farm, did everything online, and paid all the bills. I would do all my own GST, pay all the bills, still do 7 days a week out on the farm. I was out at 3 o'clock this morning checking my calving cows and heifers, back out at 8:30, and I've just come back in to have a chat to you now. And so, I've been farming all my life. I'm realistic about where we're at. And we have to get better. There's no question about that. We do have to be improving. But by global standards, New Zealand does extraordinarily well. And if one looks at the whole issue of climate change and carbon footprints, for example, these issues came up. I currently serve on the Trade and Agriculture Commission of the United Kingdom. After I left London, the then Prime Minister in the United Kingdom, Boris Johnson, said to me, "Lockwood, we want to keep you involved up here." And he and Michael Gove, another senior minister, and Liz Truss, they all wanted to keep me involved there. So they appointed me to their Trade and Agriculture Commission, first advising them on trade and agriculture policy, and then under their new laws around post-Brexit, around their ratification of free trade agreements, they then appointed me to their second Trade and Agriculture Commission that now advises them on all their free trade agreements. And as part of that work, the whole issue of New Zealand's carbon footprint came up in relation to our free trade agreement with the UK. We got the commission I'm on, got the NGOs in the UK, some of our green NGOs submitted that it would be terrible to have more product coming from New Zealand because it would lead to higher emissions because you're transporting this product halfway around the world. And I was able to use ag research work from New Zealand here, Stuart Ledgard's work, some of it, looking at the whole carbon footprint of New Zealand produced primary products, especially beef, lamb, and dairy products. And that work showed that we could ship those products to London at a lower total carbon footprint than they could produce it themselves by quite a margin. And so, by global standards, New Zealand is one of the most efficient, carbon efficient countries in the world. The problem we have, I mean, that worked very successfully in convincing the government in the UK that, in fact, allowing more imports from New Zealand would not increase carbon emissions. In fact, if anything, if it was replacing product from Europe, it would reduce carbon emissions. So that worked very well. But the problem we face globally is that the accounting system for assessing emissions in food production is deeply flawed. And if New Zealand's economy was based on the export of oil, New Zealand's emissions profile would look very good. Norway's economy, for example, is based on the export of oil. And everyone says how wonderful Norway is, that its emissions per head of population are very low, whereas New Zealand's are much higher. But of course, our economy is based on the export of food. And with food, the emissions are accounted for in the country that produces the food, whereas with oil, the emissions are accounted for in the country that uses it. Now, oil provides the energy for the industrial world. Food provides the energy for the living world, for the human world. And yet they are accounted for totally differently. And there's just so much about the accounting system that is so flawed. And it's why you may have heard me in the past talk about the desperate need to shift the accounting of carbon emissions in food production towards carbon efficiency per unit of nutrient value in food. There's a desperate need to do that globally, or we'll end in tears. We'll end with actually the world having more emissions associated with food production rather than less. And we can make such progress in improving the carbon efficiency of our food production globally. But the focus has to go on to that instead of the rather, it's almost juvenile approach to sort of countries' gross emissions, even net emissions, with respect to food production.
Yeah, and so for someone like me, Lockwood, it's after living through all this change to having measurements for carbon footprinting and similar sort of aspects to that, it frustrates me because we had the gold standard, which was subsidy-free farming, and you have alluded to the massive productivity gain in the sheep industry over the ensuing sort of 35, 40 years. Yet it was never good enough, it seemed. And we got caught up in this footprinting, this carbon footprinting. And it seems to have grown a big machine around it that sort of interferes with the free and fair trade that I thought we were going to be part of. I know it's a big world, and I'm speaking from a little place called Waimatua in southern New Zealand, but it just strikes me that we've allowed this concept of footprinting through everything we do. And it seems to have come at great cost rather than great benefit.
Well, I think, Don, we do have to make sure we can measure our emissions efficiency. to me. In other words, because the issue of climate change is, I think, accepted to be real, and we ha and as a major food producer, we have to be focused on it and improving our carbon efficiency. But to me, there is some, the first thing we need to do is sort out the variable. Well, no, let me come back one step further. I worry for the sheep industry because the sheep industry has made huge carbon efficiency progress. It's been massive. Whereas my industry, the beef industry, has made very little progress, very little progress since 1990. And yet the opportunity for us to make much more progress is there. But we've got to accept the fact the dairy industry has done rather better than the beef industry. The beef industry is the laggard of the three. But the star has been the sheep industry. And therefore, to expect the sheep industry to make huge further gains in efficiency, I think is unrealistic. I think we can make some further progress, but it won't be anywhere near as great as the progress that could be made in the beef industry. And yet we're not showing any inclination at the moment to actually get serious about progress in the beef industry. The first step would be to get some fundamental data on the carbon efficiency variability across the beef industry. I suggest it would be over plus or minus 50%. Well over. I would suggest our most efficient beef production in terms of emissions of carbon, or even just dealing with methane initially, methane emissions per kilogram of beef, for example. I'd argue the range, the variability is probably at least plus or minus 50%. We already know that if we source more beef from the dairy industry, we bring the emissions per kilogram of beef down significantly, and we're going to have to do that. I know some farmers may not like the idea. It's going to be challenging, but actually, we're going to have to do it because we do have to keep improving the carbon efficiency. Now, a lot of people are putting the emphasis on new measures like vaccines or boluses to modify the microbes in the rumen to produce less methane. And I think in the medium term, there's some real opportunity there indeed. But look what's happened with antibiotic resistance, and look what's happened with drench resistance. I mean, the bugs in the rumen are probably able to evolve to beat whatever we try to do to suppress methanogens more rapidly than bugs can evolve to beat antibiotics, and certainly more rapidly than worms can evolve to beat our drenches. Yet worms have shown they've been pretty capable at evolving to beat our drenches. So therefore, to rely totally on artificial ways of suppressing methanogens in the rumen, I think is valuable in the medium term, but if that was our only approach, dangerous in the longer term, because those bugs, they'll evolve. And there's a reason why, the ruminant animal is a staggering creature, an amazing creature. The ruminant animal can turn the bulk of what is produced by plants, which of course is the basis of that captures the energy from sunlight that sustains the entire living world. And interestingly, it's not the green bit from sunlight. The bit that sustains the living world is the blue and red light. A lot of people don't understand that the green light is the useless bit. The very reasons that plants appear green to us is they reflect green light. The living world is sustained by blue and red light, not green. In politics, it shows the huge disconnect between politics and science, that in the political world, green is the color of sustainability. In the real scientific world, the green bit's the useless bit. Blue and red light sustains the living world. But anyhow,
That's
plants create cellulose out of carbon dioxide. Another thing, people think carbon dioxide sits in the atmosphere for 1,000 years. Carbon dioxide is fluxing through the atmosphere the whole time because we are made of it. Every molecule in our bodies has a carbon skeleton, and every atom of that carbon comes from carbon dioxide. If we eat lettuce, it was possibly carbon dioxide just a month ago, and or even a couple of weeks ago. And people don't seem to understand that. Those who call carbon dioxide pollution, well, I'm sorry, your body is made of it. And if you think it's pollution, you are made of pollution, like it or not, because it's the only, if you take the major elements of our bodies, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, the only bit that comes directly from the atmosphere is the carbon. The rest comes via the ground, but The entire, all the carbon comes from the atmosphere, and every molecule has a carbon skeleton. Anyhow, I mean, I get into this stuff because I used to run a science show for kids after school in Australia, and it used to, and also as Minister of Education, it used to frustrate me how limited our understandings of science really are, and sadly, those who put together the accounting system for carbon, for especially methane emissions, in my opinion, had a limited understanding of ruminant metabolism and the scientific world.
Right. So look what now we have guests from all sides of the spectrum here on the show. There'll be ones who debate the fact that what can a country that has 0.17% of the world's gross emissions, do by further decimating itself? There's others who are on the other side. No, we must do everything. But it all comes back to, and often this argument that comes, that we need access to those markets. We need access to those markets. And you were talking a moment ago about, certain NGOs, the ones that you worked with, then you were talking about the FTA in the UK. Now, if you look at what's happening in New Zealand, I recently saw a submission by a coalition of four NGOs. This was the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund, Forest and Bird, Pure Advantage, the Environmental Defence Society, all of these joining together, banding forces, and submitting to MFAT that New Zealand is effectively in breach of the FTA. That came into effect recently because, and I mean, I find it so far-fetched. They say the fact that this new government has stopped work on certain environmental initiatives, has stopped work on further work on public transport and all. We've given a field day to these NGOs to now start attacking pretty much the sector. It's open season. And how, that's where I wonder with all these FTAs, are we tying ourselves into knots because all they say, look after region agriculture or work further towards aquaculture conservation and so on. It is not quantified. And we end up with this constant tussle between farmers and these NGOs. Where does this end?
I think we farmers have to get a little more, what's the word I'm looking for, forceful in responding to some of that nonsense from some of the NGOs. I've got the New Zealand FTA sitting right here beside me because I worked on every chapter, relevant chapter of it. I mean, I advised the United Kingdom, the government of the United Kingdom, on every aspect to do with animal welfare, plant animal health, and the environment on every as all those elements in both the Australian Free Trade Agreement, the New Zealand Free Trade Agreement, and the UK's accession to CPTPP. We had to explore in all member countries of CPTPP, all those elements, how they treat the environment. So I've got all the details sitting right here beside me. And some of what those NGOs claim is simply nonsense, tragically. And we need to, I think in the farming sector, we need a stronger voice that understands the science more clearly to absolutely push back on some of the nonsense that comes because the free trade agreement with the UK certainly requires us not to breach international agreements with respect to the environment. For example, if New Zealand were to breach our Paris Accord commitments, that might have implications with respect to our FTA. The FTA requires us the fundamental thing around the environment. What the FTA requires us to do is to uphold our own laws. And so, New Zealand does that better than most countries. We had to, for example, on the UK's accession to CPTPP, explore whether we could be certain that, say, in countries producing coconut oil, pardon me, whether their systems of auditing environmental issues there were robust or not. We had to go through all that kind of detail. And so, we need to push back because a lot of work's been done on exploring the auditing systems in countries to make sure that they do comply with their own laws. And New Zealand, above most countries, we have a very good record at complying with our own laws.
Right. And so one angle from that point of view, though, would be that we consistently make more onerous laws day by day in this country. And there's so many of the influence of the NGOs seems to be quite oppressive. They seem to get through the gate easier than those of us that want to speak logic and reason and be real about stuff. And so, you know, while it sounds great for environmental standards to be enhanced, like whether we talk about diffuse nutrient movement through soils, or whether it's point source discharges, or whether it's a cumulative effect, I mean, there's always one more step. It's never good enough. And I, my case in point, I'll just make this point. I'm aware of dairy farmers in my province that are on their third effluent system, all decreed by the local authorities, but it's never good enough. They want it to be ever evolving at great cost. And now I see where we're talking about, it looks like where you may see irrigation of effluent onto properties is now being considered perhaps too diffuse and likely to be more regulated. And I don't know where these farmers are going to go next. But anyway, it's the evolution of ideas. But yeah, you know, that's my point. The NGOs have had a huge sway over the regulator.
I think you're right, Don, that you know, the NGOs have certainly had very good access to the media. You know, the media tends to love running their stories. If an environmental issue comes up, for example, they turn to Greenpeace. Yet scientifically, what Greenpeace utters is illiterate. You know, it's, some of their utterances are absolutely scientifically illiterate. I mean, I speak with some authority in science. I have, you know, I was a Massey scholar in agricultural science, specializing in ruminant nutrition, specializing in scientific method. I used to lecture in scientific method at Massey. I was then a Commonwealth scholar, and my PhD is in ruminant metabolism. And so I'm a distinguished alumni of Massey University and a lecturer at the age of 21. I was a lecturer at Massey University at the age of 21. What's that now? Over 50 years ago, I was a lecturer at Massey. And so, you know, I chair the board of the Reddit Research Institute at the moment. So, you know, I'm fairly, all my life I've been heavily involved in science. So I speak with some authority on science. I think with the governments, it depends on what government you have. And I think it would be perhaps a fair criticism of the last Labour-led government that they listened to the NGOs too much and went way over top in terms of their proposed regulation around farming. I think it's fair to say the current government is taking a much more measured approach. I suspect you would say, Don, the jury is still out as to whether the more measured approach is going to achieve the kind of outcomes would make farmers happier. I think we do have to accept that standards will inevitably continue to rise. The issue for us is making sure that the higher standards the world seeks environmentally are sensible and practical, you know, that they actually achieve the outcomes being sought. One of the problems with regulation, I know a lot of my life I've experienced regulation because I was in politics for 29 years, and so much regulation produces perverse outcomes, unexpected outcomes or perverse outcomes. And it stands to reason, because when you try to regulate something, inevitably you can't produce a regulation that meets the huge diversity of situations in the natural world, across New Zealand. I mean, just on my farm alone, my little farm, the soil types vary hugely. The way I manage just my little 900 acres here, or 300 and something hectares here, differs because the soils are so different from one part of the farm to the other, to another. And to try and have regulations, you know, across New Zealand that make environmental sense is hugely dangerous. The risk of perverse outcomes is so high. And that's why I think an approach looking at catchment areas, working more closely with farmers to make sure that regulation in the future makes sense at a local level. And sadly, we've even got to educate our regional councils more to make sure that they don't pursue impractical regulatory approaches that are going to produce actually unhelpful outcomes. And so there's a huge challenge here to try and get an improved understanding that you've got to work with farmers at a local level and get everyone on board to be improving things step by step. It's not a huge change overnight. We make progress one step at a time.
You said the jury might be out, you know, whether this government is changing this influence. And when we have these NGOs, the four that I mentioned, saying that we are in breach of Chapter 22 of the UKFTA because the clean car discount has been canned and that the climate adaptation finance has been put into tax relief, one wonders where this is going. Yet, Sir Lockwood, recently, the same NGOs, one of them, the Environmental Defence Society, it worked with Auckland Council, the Wellington Council, and a couple of big consultants and banks to bring together a seminar for the public, for them to understand what the Coastal Adaptation Act that the government is now going to look into, what it's going to look like. So the influence is not just at center government level. It is, you know, it spans the entire gamut of your local government right down to your local consultants. And that's what worries me, that the playing field is not leveled to a large extent. A lot of this, the policymakers have been captured, or maybe this is just my cynicism here showing through, or my inexperience, it could be.
No, I don't think it's. I don't think I'd criticize you for cynicism there at all, Jaspreet. I think you're right that the NGOs are very effective at bringing together coalitions to try and influence outcomes. And I think the Environmental Defence Society was recently involved in a major conference where the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, Honourable Simon Upton, spoke. And I think he gave environmentalists a very appropriate reminder that there's a huge difference between what idealists may think is the nirvana or the gold standard out there and the realities of achieving it. And it frustrates me often that those who yell the loudest about environmental issues, clutch their cell phones and all the technologies that that New Zealand's economy provides, all these important technologies New Zealand's economy provides for them, all funded through our agricultural primary sector exports. And I think we've it's so important that we, those of us involved in primary production, don't take the line that we're perfect, that we don't need to do anything, that we don't, environmental issues are not important to us. They are important. We've got to make sure people understand we do care deeply about the environment, that we are all the time working to try and minimize environmental risks. And I think it's so important that we include in our messages that we're endlessly working, because if farmers don't care for the environment, their production will go down over a period of time. The environment doesn't take kindly to abuse. And so we farmers are all the time conscious, all the time I'm conscious of damage to paddocks, of pugging, of runoff, of silt up here in our area. It's not so much nitrogen. I don't apply any urea on my farm. It's not so much my stocking rate is not that high. But pugging is an issue in the winter. And so we need to be mindful all the time of how we are working to forever be improving our land and our farming operations. I think you talk to any farmer, I always will tell you that one of their aims is to leave their property in a better state from which they took it over. And that's so important that people understand that we're not just trying to produce more and more stuff. We're actually trying to make sure our properties are left when we finish with them in a better state than when we started.
So does it disappoint you, Lockwood, that after sort of 35 or more years of those, including the productivity gains from the sheep and beef, sorry, the sheep sector, that our land that was, the sort of Midland lands being converted into forestry, one aspect, that deserves attention, in my opinion. So probably I need to back up a wee bit. The issue for me is, having been a sheep and beef farmer, especially a meat and wool farmer for sort of my first 30 years farming, I probably only had 2 good years, maybe three, and the rest were just treading water. Why is it that the sheep meat industry and the wool industry, for all this, and it'll be international markets, but we seem to have done all this good and hard work, but it was always usurped by a better and higher option in the lowlands called dairying. It just happened that way. The sheep industry couldn't compete.
You've brought together a whole range of issues
Yeah,
there, John.
sorry.
Let me deal with your last one, then I'd love to get on to your first one about good farming hill country being planted in pines. I'll come back to that. But I think one of the realities that that we have to accept is that milk production via a dairy cow is a very efficient way of producing high quality protein for human beings. Milk is an extraordinary product, and increasingly Fonterra is taking it to bits and extracting from milk very high value products that are very valuable to human well-being, and it is a very high value product, whereas red meat is still a very valuable product, but it struggles to compete with just the sheer nutritive value of dairy product, and its ease of conversion into a whole range of food products, from infant formula through to cheese, beautiful cheeses, and you name it. Milk proteins are involved in so much. Milk components are involved in so much of global food production. Quite extraordinary. Where I'd be a little bit critical, perhaps, because I've never been, I mean, I've worked on dairy farms, but I've never actually been involved in dairy farming myself. I think there was a period of time going back a few years where, probably when the prices were really high, intensity overstepped the marker a little bit. I think in parts of the South Island in particular there, I think the use of high levels of input, high levels of urea, possibly, did start to have some environmental impacts that were unhelpful. But I think we're seeing dairying now withdrawing back from that a bit, and it needs to. I think we've got to make sure dairying is fully sustainable. But it'll always be competitive for quality land. There's no question about that. I'm surrounded by dairy farmers. I'm one of the very few beef farmers in this immediate area here. But let me come to your first point. You wondered whether I'd be disappointed about hill country land being planted in pines. But I'm not disappointed. I'm horrified. I'm just horrified to see so much very good hill country farmland being planted in pines. I not long ago visited the Wairere Romney Stud in the Northern Wairarapa, which isn't quite reasonably high hill country there. A very well-run property. And very successful, Romney Stud, I might say. Productivity tremendous. Next door, not far away, was another outstandingly good property that the owner of Wairere took and showed me. This nearby property, pasture in beautiful condition, a sealed runway for aerial top dressing, every fence fully maintained, far better than my property. I'd salute the previous owners of this property that had a magnificent hill country sheep farming property. Every acre of it now in pine trees. And it just made me cry to see it because, I think New Zealand, talk about perverse outcomes. New Zealand one day will rue the fact that so much of our land is being now planted in pine trees. And my family's history has been involved in the timber industry. My father used to mill pine trees. Our farm had a little timber mill on it. And originally my family was involved in the great kauri industry. They had the biggest timber mill in the Southern Hemisphere there for a while at Matakoi, and exported timber under the brand Smith Brothers Matakoi. And so my family's been heavily involved in the timber industry, and there's a huge place for the timber industry. But to see good farming country just planted, blanket planted in pines, it'll actually have impacts on our tourist industry as well. And it used to be a wonderful drive from Napier to Taupo, wonderful drive. The scenery from Napier to Taupo, beautiful. And more of it's now just driving through pine trees. It makes me cry.
Yes, and we were farming at one point not far from there in Otrohonga, and you would drive down to Taupo, and more it was becoming like the land of the dark green pine there. But the last government, and that's all its wisdom, had brought in the special forestry test 2018, and there came the gold rush. No one really thought of the repercussions, even though at you know, you had locals pushing back at various levels. You had local governments trying to do, you know, or at least try to raise awareness. None of this changed. And we now have big overseas companies who have bought these because we are amongst the handful, I think just two in the world, Lockwood, that allow 100% offsets via pine to continue. And meanwhile, our national carrier, which has been part of, you know, it has planted pines in some of the biodiversity hotspots around Marlborough, has dumped its 2030 targets, saying that it is no longer, you know, it is realized it's not feasible, it's not economic. But what about the rural sector? I have seen personally places which are suddenly thriving communities, they just stop. There are less children going to school. You know, a couple of farms have been sold into pines, less jobs. Yes, there's an initial job rush, a few, not even a job rush. But then for 20 years, nothing happens. These communities have been, can I dare say, use the word deliberately devastated. It was very, very short-sighted.
And you're so right, Jaspreet. I mean, the Parliamentary Commission for the Environment, Simon Upton, has already made very clear in his view, and Simon's got a tremendous wealth of experience behind him too. Simon has argued we should not allow companies, especially international companies, to offset their carbon emissions by planting pine trees, blanket planting of pine trees here in New Zealand. And I think he's dead right. You know, we've got to, I keep coming back to carbon efficiency. We cannot deal with climate change by endlessly planting pine trees. Now, we've actually got to improve our carbon efficiency. I mean, we don't create any more carbon. I mean, the carbon in the world we have exists. You neither create nor destroy carbon. And it's a matter of where it is and how it's used. And we've got to make sure that we're forever improving the efficiency and our utilization of carbon. And until we do that, I think we're going to end up with perverse outcomes it worries me that, I mean, climate change is hugely important and we do need to deal with it. But what worries me is those who argue that it's a crisis risk doing dumb things and trying to deal with the crisis, and we risk actually worse outcomes for humankind.
You know, yes. Some of our biggest emitters in the world are countries like homeland for me, India, the neighboring country, China over there, India doesn't even have a national herd scheme. Depending on which government website you look at, you could have anything from 60 million to 80 million ruminants. You try telling a farmer there that your cows are destroying the world. I can't even say what the answer I would get there. And yet we have right now a country that is, you know, a quarter, less than a quarter of a percent, so Lockwood. We are trying to continuously somehow be the first ones off the block. And I don't think this is our place to be. Our credentials should be selling themselves. Where is the premium that they say that we should be getting today? That, you know, for all of that we've done, I mean, the payouts are nowhere. When I came to New Zealand in 2008-09, a $5.90 or $5.60 was really good. And now we have people struggling to survive at over $8. Yeah. Sheep and beef farms, they've had a 58% drop in profits last year. That was followed by the previous year, which had a 31%. Somewhere the rubber must hit the road now.
You're so right that, India, I think, has the most
cows in the world. Yep.
And but the issue for us is, it's not one of... you know, why are we doing this? Because, you know, we've got fewer cows. The issue is we are a major marketer of food products. I think New Zealand probably manages close to a third of all inter-country trade in dairy products. So we're a major player in international trade in food products, especially dairy products. Pardon me. And therefore, while it seems crazy that our total production is so small, if we want to maintain access to high value markets, it's not a matter of getting a premium for our products. It's a matter of ongoing access. And if we weren't one of the more carbon efficient, one of the most carbon efficient producers of dairy, beef, dairy products and red meat products, livestock products, if you like, on a global standard, we would not have achieved the free trade agreement with the United Kingdom. The fact that our research shows that our highly productive systems do mean that we're the most carbon efficient of any country in the world in production of livestock products, of ruminant products, was what helped us achieve our free trade agreement with the United Kingdom. And that free trade agreement is huge, proving hugely valuable at the moment, as China's demand is in kind of recess at the moment, and improved access to the UK is proving pretty helpful at the moment. And so that's the point. It's not, and I'm not one who says that we're going to lose access to these markets tomorrow if we don't do all sorts of crazy things around carbon emissions, around methane emissions. But we do, in my opinion, have to be forever improving our efficiency. One of the interesting conundrums to me is, if you look at AgriZero, for example, that organization here in New Zealand, their objective is to try and achieve net zero emissions around agricultural products. Yet when you listen, and supporting AgriZero, outfits like Fonterra, yet if you listen to the CEO of Fonterra, he talks about internationally the importance of carbon efficiency in our dairy products. And that's, to me, I find quite interesting that on the one hand, everyone knows what's needed. What's needed is improving carbon efficiency.
Yes.
Yet from a marketing perspective, we still talk about such simplistic things as net zero. Because I guess it's easy to understand. Net zero is much easier to understand than improving carbon efficiency. Because so few people understand food's made out of carbon. And so we've got to me, our access and our success in the international marketing of our primary of our livestock products, if we look to the future, will depend on continuously improving our carbon efficiency, especially in our beef sector, dairy sector as well. But as I said earlier on, I think we've got to be realistic about what's possible in the sheep sector, because you've achieved so much in the last 30 years, such staggering improvement in carbon efficiency in the last 30 years.
Yeah, if only we would, just focus on nutrition. That's probably my thing. When you have dairy companies like Miraka that have recently signed an agreement with China to export low carbon milk, I just think this is the branding. We are low carbon milk as it is. And I know China over the last couple of years has quadrupled its renewable energy, but it still has over 250 coal-fired plants. So what are we trying to do here, Let's not tie ourselves into more knots than we have to and draw a line somewhere. That for me was like, one just out of left field, trying to sell low carbon milk to China. Yeah.
I think the important thing for us is to make sure that, if we look at where, for example, Heiwaka Eke Noa got to, I think that was headed towards a really perverse outcome. I think that would have ended in tears. And it's so important that that was abandoned. But what's so important is that for the long-term future, we're not driven by short-term marketing initiatives. I mean, I was involved in marketing. I used to manage part of the New Zealand Dairy Board's marketing activities around the whole of Southern Eastern Asia. I personally launched Anchor Brand Milk Powder in the Philippines. I even used my voice in all the radio and television ads, because there they, of course, speak with American accent. My voice on radio and television just stuck out. It's so important that New Zealand's success in agriculture has been that over the decades since it started way back in the mid to late 1800s, has been that it's been driven by scientific research. Every aspect of agriculture in New Zealand has, in the past, been driven by sound science. You go back to some of our leading politicians. I remember the Right Honourable Gordon Coates, who lived just down the road, along the road from me here, New Zealand's first New Zealand-born Prime Minister, talking about the days of the thumb, what is it, the rule of thumb and the slasher are gone. Science had to drive our future in agriculture. And that was, he made that statement when the government decided to fund the development of Massey Agricultural College in Palmerston North there. And every aspect of our agriculture has been driven by science. And that's what's got to drive our future. Sure, marketing initiatives are great in the short term. So net zero and that sort of infant formula, net zero infant formula, great for a short-term marketing initiative. I've got no problem with that at all. But we must make sure what underpins the ongoing development of agriculture in New Zealand is sound science, because that will ultimately win the day. It will ultimately win the day. There'll be a lot of noise, and a lot of people have all sorts of crazy ideas. But ultimately, it is sound science that will win the day.
Right. And so we've had almost an hour of your time, but I've got one last question to ask you, Sir Lockwood, and that is around the monetization of nature programs that are going on around New Zealand and Australia now, the biodiversity credit market, and effectively, I take it back to the CO2 market. The price, I think, the government's struggling to get its auction price met. What they call that floor price met, and
Okay.
so they're failing. But the previous government had this ambition of the CO2 price being $250 a ton or even more, and they're struggling to get sort of 40 to 60 now. Do you see this attempt to monetize nature and monetize the likes of CO2 as a slippery slope?
It's an interesting question, Don, because often I reflect on the fact that there's a price on carbon. And what people don't understand is they're putting a price on the very building block of life. Can I
Yes.
keep coming back to that fact? People have no understanding that carbon from carbon dioxide is what living things are made of. That is what all living things are made of. They're made from the carbon, from carbon dioxide. And we're putting a price on the building block of life. And a few people understand that. I think in terms of reality, I think emissions trading schemes are a way of improving carbon efficiency in the wider economy. Where How they're applied, though, to living systems or to food production becomes critically important. And I think there is an element in there that where biodiversity can be part of and parcel of that development, but how we achieve it has not yet been, in my view, successfully brought together. One of the things that does amuse me a little bit about biodiversity is we talk about it a lot. As a farmer here in Northland, if you tried to prevent biodiversity from happening, you wouldn't have a hope in hell. You can sow out there in the on the paddocks whatever you like. You can sow a monoculture of ryegrass if you like. Within 5 years, it'll be almost everything but ryegrass. And nature has its way of pursuing biodiversity left to its own devices. And
Right.
I think how we go about in court. Now, obviously, there's a more desirable kind of biodiversity that we're seeking. We're seeking, obviously, more incorporation of New Zealand indigenous vegetation, for example, to stabilize land in certain areas, etc., to improve wetlands and all that kind of thing. And all that's part and parcel of that stepwise improvement in our environment. But how we incorporate it into our measures to help improve carbon efficiency and deal with carbon emissions globally is so important, and I just don't think we've quite got that right yet. I think emissions trading, great for the industrial sector, so long as they're not allowed to do too much offsetting of instead of improving carbon efficiency genuinely. But in the food production sector, I think there's a real opportunity there to explore further how we incorporate pricing at the margin, how we incorporate not pricing all carbon emissions, but pricing at the margin of carbon emissions, how we can find incentives for all farmers to be continuously looking to improve our carbon efficiency.
Look, and that's a great place to end this. Heck, we had so much more on our list to go through. Like, we wanted to talk about your Belgian blues and the genetic things. We wanted to talk about gene editing and CRISPR, a whole lot of things. But look, for our listeners, you've given us a huge swathe of knowledge here that many of our listeners will not have heard from anyone else. We try to do our best on our side of the ledger, but your knowledge, your experience, your commitment to the sector is so obvious. And look, So, Lockwood, we're just grateful you were able to find the time to come on our show, and we hope our listeners take as much out of it as we have. So, thank you for coming on again.
Well, thanks for the chance to chat to you. I'm happy to talk to you some other time about other things, because to me, the gene editing question, Don, is so important. I used to say way back in the late 90s when I was Minister of Agriculture that gene editing offers humankind the greatest benefits of any technology ever developed. And it's just, to me, criminal that's been, not possible for us to pursue the benefits of it till now.
Well, I can assure you that comment will give us feedback on steroids. There's a lot of people very tense about this at the moment, and I don't understand it enough to make a comment one way or the other. But look, it's a genie that perhaps is out of the bottle and needs to be analyzed a lot more, because society, the way the people that we've given us feedback and our shows to date are a bit tense about it all. So look, we may come back to that another day,
Okay.
Lockwood, and get onto it. But look, we've had an hour of your time now, way over our time limit, and it's been just fabulous. Thanks very much.
It's been lovely talking to you both. All the very best. Look forward to catching up again.
Thank you so much.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.